So again, I think our agenda is to start with a presentation by Roland to really explain the concept to us, and then, you know, really, I think we'll kind of go from there. The only other thing that I'll mention is to repeat that there is an expectation that we are going to be doing work other than just coming to these meetings. And as the moderator, I feel like it's my role to make sure that I assign things to everybody else other than myself. If you're not here, the chances of you getting assignments are much higher. We are to schedule a get together, and you know, we'll figure that out before we break up here this evening, sometime over the course of the next month before the May 20th meeting, and we can figure out night and day and all those kinds of things. I would also recommend that we kind of establish in our own little world here, some email communications to each other. I would like to say that I'd like to be a little bit of a stickler about the reply all button. I think this is really going to generate a lot of email. Let's say, for example, we're talking about organizing the next meeting and what time it is, and I send out an email and ask everybody about when they're going to be here. Reply to me. Not everybody has to know that you can't make it Thursday morning at 10. Okay? So let's just try to control the email traffic a little. On the other hand, with that said, I actually think that it's a really useful tool for a group like this to be able to interact with each other. So anyway, let's try to behave. Let's just do just hi, I'm, and my profession is level of intro around the table here. So hi, I'm Carl Elefante. I'm the moderator. We're going to figure out what that means over the course of the next couple of months. I'm an architect in practice in Washington, D.C., and I'm a longtime resident of Montgomery County.
I'm Lisa Rother, and I worked for the City of Rockville and Montgomery County for many years. I now run the local district council of the Urban Land Institute.
I'm Bill Commoners. I'm a land use lawyer practicing in Montgomery County native resident of Montgomery County.
Pat Baptiste, longtime native of Montgomery County. Have been active in a lot of citizen organizations engaged in zoning conversations, and I was a two-term member of the County Planning Board.
John Delaney, a land use lawyer. I'm just visiting here as the chairman of the group. I get to sort of float around. That's pretty indicative of what they think of me, but
Are you a floating zone?
Floating zone, change
to floating zoner.
Sometimes a mistake.
No, more of a mistake. But I look forward to this. I think this is really a major challenge for the county, this whole project. And the CR zone is right in the center of it. And we have a lot of work to do.
Joe Alfondre, I'm here because my last name rhymes with Carl's. I've been looking for this forever. I'm a current commissioner.
I'm Diana Conway. I'm a PTA activist mom who got led into the land use stuff through school stuff, and I'm a board member of West Montgomery County Citizens Association for the last 12 years, and of Montgomery Countryside Alliance, which is dedicated to protecting the ag reserve.
I'm Roy Sampson. I just didn't know when to retire.
You tried.
Ken Hurdle, lifelong resident of Montgomery County. Got teeth wrapped into zoning and land use as a president of the Luxmere Citizens Association back in the early 90s. And first thing in front of my plate was the Davis Kenwooter track, which is the corner of 270 and Old Georgetown Road, 54 acres. And for the 3 years I was president, I lived that. So I learned a lot about zoning. Currently, I work as a consultant.
Garth Rockhassel, Dean of the School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation at the University of Maryland, and a practicing architect.
John Eisen, I'm the managing principal of Street Sense, architects, planners, developers, retail brokers, all sorts of things. Native of Montgomery County as well. I'm glad to be here.
Cameron Pratt with Folger Pratt Development. We development firm that does a lot of work in Montgomery County.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again. I think let's get right into business. And, you know, so Roland is going to, you know, go through the CR zone proposal. We've all had for a couple of weeks a copy that we now have a somewhat superseded version of. So presumably any comments that you made to yourself, you know, doing your homework previously on this, will still apply.
They still apply because the new version is basically taking what we'd done before and put it more into the Montgomery County format with some tweaks, which if you have questions, we can talk about.
Can we back for just 1 second, and maybe I missed this, but this zone, I mean, I understand that we're looking at it. Is it meant to replace all commercial and residential zones?
Or no. It's meant to replace the commercial
and mixed use zones.
Right. So, because we have separate commercial zones and we have mixed use zones.
Right.
So the experiences in a lot of other places is this is the type of approach they use to the thinking being that there's no reason now for a singular commercial zone. Everything should have some mix of uses. The reason we're bringing this first, and Royce, please jump in at any time, is we have three major master plans under the way: Germantown, White Flint, and Gaithersburg West, or what some people know as the life sciences. And we wanted to get up front with the zone that can be used in all the in parts of all those master plans. And so this is evolving along with the White Flint process, but what we're talking about is a generic zone that can go throughout the county. And it would be tweaked, as you'll see as I discuss. And so the planning board is in the work sessions now, deeply in with White Flint. And as Ken will tell you, and I'm not sure if anybody else was, were you here last night, Bill? No. We had this room with about 20 people in it last night where we discussed what I'm about to show you in that piece of paper as it applies to White Flint. And I urge Ken to jump in any time with his thoughts about how that went.
I'm on the steering committee for the Citizens Advisory Group for 2.5 years, and I'm on the steering committee for White Flint.
And that steering committee is, and again, correct me if I miss anything, is folks like Ken who represent neighborhood groups around the area as well as developers who were there. And we're getting into this in depth last night, just as we will hopefully do tonight. Sure.
So what's the timeline? It sounds like you're well down the road with the White Flint Master Plan. I know you are. Are we, you know, I mean, is this a foregone conclusion, this zone that is in the Master Plan that you're moving forward with?
This zone is not in the Master Plan.
It's not?
No. Okay. Royce, do you want to say anything about TMX?
Well, right now, they had started the Master Plan assuming that the TMX zone would be used.
Mm-hmm.
But since the TMX zone was limited essentially to the Twin Brook
right.
Master Plan because of the density mm-hmm. that was allowed, we thought it was a good opportunity to open the issue more widely
mm-hmm.
and see if we could devise a zone that would not only work in White Flint but could work in other places as well. And could also be a prototype for the kind of general revision of the zoning ordinance that we're undertaking. And since we got to deal with mixed use in
right.
these areas, it was also a good place to test it out for reality so that we're not doing it in the abstract.
So this is not in the White Flint Master Plan? You're still moving forward with TMX, but you're kind of testing it?
At this point, we don't have a zone for White Flint. So we're hoping to have this zone or what comes out of this process, whether it's still called CR or
right.
the world's best zone, when it comes out of this process, we hope to have it ready by the time we send the White Flint plan to the council,
okay.
which will be June.
And is there any other questions? One of the priorities we had for this category is to come up with something that provides a greater degree of certainty to everyone involved, both the residents who live in an area as well as builders or people seeking to purchase property. And as a result, it has some basic parameters in it that spell out very clearly what has to be achieved. And so what I want to do now is just describe the nomenclature so you can understand how that works and then talk about how it flows through. And so basically, I may have stated before that we're looking at use and density, measured in floor area, of course, floor area ratio. The use is commercial residential, and that's the use, very clear. The density designations can change. These numbers are actually infinite. And in this case, this is one potential zone that would be in the White Flint area where the total floor area, so your whole building, its whole size, would be 3 times the lot area. That's what it would be. Okay? Very simple. If it was a 10,000 square foot lot, you'd get 30,000 square feet. And let's just use that as an example. We'll say it's a 10,000 square foot. I'm still getting used to square feet again. I've dealt most of my life in metric. So 10,000 square feet, 3 times that, you get a 30,000 square foot building if you decide to build the maximum. But the commercial component in this case, as determined through a master plan process of what priorities are, would be 1.5 times the lot area, or potentially half that, 15,000 square feet. So we're saying you can have this building at 30,000 square feet, but you must mix the uses if you want to build all of your floor area. You have to mix the uses. You cannot exceed 1.5 commercial. Then we go to the residential side, and in this example I'm giving you, it's exactly the same thing. It's 15,000 square feet maximum. So someone who buys this property or thinking is buying this property would step back and say, okay, I can get a building that big, and they're telling me that I must mix to get to there. And it speaks to things like the jobs to housing ratio. Those numbers can change. They could be, and actually I have an example of that. So here we are in White Flint. I'm not quite that tall. And in White Flint, we've been looking at the further you get away from a metro stop or a MARC station, your density goes down. So in the heart of White Flint, we're looking at 4 times coverage. The example I just gave you is 3 times because it's a little further away, so the density is going to come down. You're not as close to the transit. And when you get out to here, you're down to 2, the closest you are in relative to the neighborhoods. And so those numbers I'm showing you, as you move outside those rings, would get lower. So the one on the furthest next to the neighborhood would be, for example, a total density of 2 times, where we'd probably only look at a commercial coverage of 0.5, so you might have a little bit of ground floor retail, or we might allow the residential to be the full amount. And then a developer could decide, well, I could provide a little commercial, and if I do that, that's 0.5. I hope I'm writing this right from the side. And you add up 1.5 commercial, or sorry, residential, and that equals your 2. Or they could decide to do it all residential, because it's further away from where most commercial uses would locate. Now that's in an area like White Flint, which will have some tall buildings in the middle of that area. But we're also doing the Kensington sector plan, where we're looking at University, Knowles, and I'm sure everybody's probably familiar with this intersection. And you see the shaded area where we're actually looking at, well, what kind of categories could we put in there? And when you look at the uses that we're thinking about in there, there's a lot of different stuff. The CR uses themselves will allow all those things that we'd like to see and the neighborhood's expressing an interest in. But the density totals there may be lower. They may only be, in that area, I don't know what they're coming up with, but it might be a 2. And the commercial component would probably be fairly high. It might even be a 2. And the residential would probably be lower. Whereas along this strip, where you have more of a strip mall environment, and I'm not saying these are the numbers we're doing, and that's why we didn't put them on the map. The planners are very worried that I have some numbers up here that we'd say we're advocating. They haven't decided them yet. But this one where you have strip malls could be probably a 2.5, where you're probably going to want that residential component to be fairly high above a store, and you might want ground floor retail at, say, 0.5. So these zone categories for the density get changed where you apply them through the master plan process. And the mix speaks to the priorities that are identified through that public process of what we're trying to achieve. Now, going on further with this is everybody familiar with standard versus optional? Royce knows a lot more about this, so I should probably have him doing the presentation on this part. Currently, here's a building. And there's a base density level called the standard. and that's what you get. You can do that. But if you go into the optional method to get more, you have to provide benefits and amenities. And everybody's familiar with those sorts of things. What this zone is trying to do when you get into the latter pages is you'll see a chart that lists different types of amenities, and that if they're provided, you get more floor area. So let's go back to the White Flint example I used a moment ago, which was a total density of 3, and what did I have? I think I had a commercial at 1.5 floor area and a residential. What we're looking to do is to, in this area, is to provide an absolute height limit. You cannot go above that. It's absolute. What happens, however, a little different than this, is we subtract down from that. We still would set a base density level of where you could build and go ahead and provide the basic amenity packages, pretty much the same things we get today. We've added in a couple more, like bike parking and things like that, but streetscape, stuff like that. But to start to get into this zone, you've got to go to that list of public benefits. For example, a good one, if you build a LEED Gold building, that's a public benefit. You're reducing the carbon emissions of that building dramatically with a LEED Gold register. You provide, let's say as part of your LEED, you provide energy production on site, geothermal, wind power, etc. You get a bonus for that. Community connectivity. This is from LEED for Neighborhoods. You're all familiar with LEED? Okay. There's also something LEED for Neighborhoods, which is pretty much just getting to go. And the LEED for Neighborhood people are very excited about what we're talking about here. And this is also what we're talking about in the growth policy. We're trying to tie the growth policy that we're working on now, the master plan efforts that we're doing, and the zoning rewrite all into those kinds of same direction. And the LEED for Neighborhoods says that if you locate a building where you're near 10 basic services, grocery store, library, dry cleaners, etc., people won't drive as much. That's a positive thing for the community. People can walk to what they want. And what we're looking at doing is providing a bonus for that. If you have 10 basic services, and there may already be, you know, 5 down the street, and then you put 5 in your building, that equals 10, you get a floor area bonus. But those bonuses cannot put you above that amount or above the height limit. So there's certainty for everyone involved about what the absolute is. Now, we had a great I thought it was a great conversation last night. It was really a fun time. I was walking on air when I went walk back home last night. It was really, really great. And we had a diverse group of folks. And it was interesting to see how, you know, some of the developers saying, but you're asking us for more. And then I turned to JBG, who's building the new high rise on up in White Flint now on Rockville Pike, and I said, okay, tell me what you wouldn't be providing that we're requiring you to get up to there. And he only said one thing. And in this new zone, we're proposing to require a mix of units. So if you build this as a residential component, and let's say you provide 50 units, we're saying that 10% of those units have to be efficiencies, 10% have to be one bedroom, 10% have to be two bedroom, and I hope I'm not being dyslexic, 7.5% have to be three bedroom. And what's that about? That's about creating continuity in the neighborhood. And I can tell you I've been involved in a lot of situations where one bedrooms drove the market. And next thing you know, you got 20 buildings in there, they're all one bedrooms, and when people get married, they got to leave because they don't have a place to live. There's nothing built for them. When they have children, they've got to move out of the neighborhood. It doesn't do anything for seniors. I know I'm not even a senior yet, although I got my AARP card last year. I am looking for a condominium, potentially two floors, that's three bedroom, because I moved from a 3,500 square foot house and I've got all my stuff in storage up in Wheaton. But I need those options in the community to provide people for their, as their lifestyles change, to stay in the neighborhood, or allow seniors who are looking to move and downsize to come into a neighborhood. So we're saying we should mix the unit sizes. It's good for the neighborhood. It's good for the continuity of the neighborhood. And it helps provide diversity in need for all the services. So everything's sort of connected. The other things we're looking at it here and discussing, and we want to discuss in this table, is we're keeping the MPDU requirements, we're keeping the workforce housing requirements. There's a proposal in there that says, well, if you are providing those things, we won't count it in your floor area. And we're getting comments from both sides of the argument saying, well, we don't exclude it today. Why would we can continue to do it? Well, the thing is, in this building climate, it's a very, very expensive thing to provide. And we're also looking that if you go into the bonus situation, we allow you to get bonus, a continued bonus above the base for providing those uses. The big change to that is, currently, this side of the equation, the commercial side, does not have a requirement for MPDUs. It's only the residential. Now, that's an unusual thing. In most places, you'll find that both the commercial side and the residential side have to contribute when they build. Different places do it differently. We have put in here the California linkage fee formula that's used in many, many communities now in California, as small as 45,000 people, actually, where there's a linkage fee where you can either provide the housing on site or pay it into a fund and designate someone to build that housing for you. And we're proposing in the thing that that would kick in the moment you go over 35,000 square feet of commercial floor area. Now, that's really new. That's a biggie. You look like you want to.
Well, okay. I think it's something that is fairer. Next to taxing everybody to provide the affordable housing, and certainly preferable to taxing putting an exaction against the provider of market rate homes, it's much more fair to tie it to jobs, and that's what you're doing.
That's right.
The problem is going to be, I believe, that builders of retail and office in this county are not going to go down, are not going to accept that because it puts them at a disadvantage to Virginia. It is a fair way of doing it, short of taxing the whole county. That's my own personal view.
That's the exact thing that I heard last night from two or three of the developers sitting beside me, was that when you add that percentage, it's going to go into the gross lease base, to the lease price. They can't get that much more money per foot today. So how are they going to add it on to get that linkage fee to figure that miraculously the tenant's going to pay that much more money?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, as a developer, when we look at MPDUs, we look at all the, it's just money. You know, it's just money. It doesn't matter if, you know, where you spend the money. It's just money. And it just adds to the cost. And so there's a point at which it's just too much. And that's the concern. I mean, you know, yeah, it's a great thing to have this diversity, you know, the mix of, you know, unit types. And I mean, all this stuff's great. But it's just, you get to a point where you just can't afford it. And we are competing against other jurisdictions, you know, in this area. And so, I mean, it's something that has to be looked at very closely. And to the comment about the mixture of uses, the mixture of unit types, I agree. I mean, I think, again, the concept makes total sense. But some unit types are they're not profitable. And so when you're already saying build all the MPDUs, which are, you know, you have to subsidize, and now you're saying build three-bedroom apartments in a market that you can't get enough rent for a three-bedroom apartment to justify building it. Now you have to subsidize, MPDUs, workforce, and now you're saying build unit types that you can't get enough rent to justify building. It's just another tax on a project. And, you know, at some point, you know, people just stop. You know, they're going to go to Virginia. They're going to go to the district. I mean, the district's much easier environment to develop in right now than Montgomery County, without a doubt.
Well, and even for the commercial space or commercial office, you're competing not only with Virginia, but with those other existing buildings in Montgomery County.
Exactly.
That don't have those obligations and costs.
That's exactly right.
That is another issue.
And there's a lot of vacancy right now.
Development should help pay for that, not just new development.
Right. Well, that's why the tax has been the fairer one. But you also have the question of if those are not profitable, and if you can't generate enough revenue from the building because of all these elements that you have to pay for, you're not going to get it financed to be able to build it anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, if these are all great initiatives, but when you lop on too much stuff, you're going to just stifle development. I mean, stuff's just not going to happen.
Cameron, are you saying also another thing, that it's already expensive enough, and so what you're hearing Rollins saying is this is a net addition to what you already got?
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
And it's a challenge right now, and it has been a challenge for the last 10 years because pass-throughs of commercial properties particularly have continually gone up. And when the pass-throughs get more expensive, it just compounds the cost of operating the building. It pushes pressure back on the tenants to pay more to be in the buildings. And now if you layer another on top of that, then you're going to say your CAM's going to go up. And if you don't meet this, then this is going to be a pass-through. They're going to be like, I'm going to take my 300,000 square feet and I'm going to take it to another jurisdiction.
So you're not looking at this as an incentive, the way it's been described?
No, I mean, I think it's just, you know, it's additional cost. And you can give us all the FAR in the world, but if it's not profitable to build another square foot, you can give me a million square feet. I can't build it. It just doesn't.
Let me jump in because it might be useful to convey some of the conversation from last night, and you'll keep me honest. I can tell you this has been done in many, many places, and the same discussion occurred. I remember sitting in a room where I did 10,000 one-bedroom units, and the developer I'd been dealing with came in. I said, okay, on this one I want you to put in, I think I said 10% three-bedroom. He said, I'll never make money. I said, just put it on the market. They were the first to sell, and he never had that discussion with me again. He just did it. I had to bring it closer to home. When we were negotiating before we went to the planning board on the Falklands, you know where the Falklands is, just over here, the north parcel within 800 feet of the subway stop, and it was with Home Properties, and I said, look, you want to redevelop this block, here's what we'd like. And we secured in a covenant, which we have in our hand, and we, the moment that they're guaranteed that that north block won't be designated historic, which the paperwork should go through soon, I can go down and register it on title. And over the phone, I said to the president of Home Properties, said, I would like, among other things, there was a lot of things, lead silver, possibly gold. And I asked somewhere, I can't remember the page I had, that unit mix, the 10% one bedrooms efficiency, and such, I said, I'd like to see that. He said, no, I can't do that. I said, look, are you going to build 10% of your units as efficiency? He said, yeah. I said, so that doesn't matter. He said, yeah. I said, you're going to build the one bedrooms? He said, yeah. I said, you're going to build a two-bedroom? He says, oh, absolutely. I said, that's 30% of your unit total. I said, what about the three-bedrooms? He says, that's the one I have the problem with. I said, well, what's your problem? I don't think it should be 10%. Well, what do you think it should be? He says, 5%. I said, I'll split the difference with you. And I said, can you put them at grade so we can turn them potentially into family units? He said, absolutely. And that was only 40% of the total of his units. And of his 1,000 units, or 1,100, he just looked at it and said, it's not a problem. And it truly isn't in most cases. And we're going to be testing all this from an economic standpoint.
But that case, to be fair, I mean, that critical mass is able to absorb that proportion of the larger units. When you have a 50-unit building, right, and you're in a downtown market that's looking and catering to young professionals or empty nesters that, you know, don't want three bedrooms, and the cost per unit, per land ratio starts to make them become non-economic, how do you handle it then?
I can give you an example. So we were having the same discussion last night, same arguments, and I fleshed out JBG because I know what they're building. And they're building a very high building, you know, what is it, about 260 feet or something, 70 feet? Mm-hmm. Steel and glass. Their parking is below grade. They dug a big, big hole. And I said, how does this impact you? I said, do you have 10% one bedrooms? Yes. Do you have 10% efficiencies? Yes. Do you have 10% two bedrooms? Yes. I said, what's your problem? He says, it's with the three bedrooms. But in reality, I think he only has 120 units there. The requirement for the three bedrooms is very, very low. And I can tell you, because this is happening right now in the Midwest and other locations, that they get filled up by people downsizing in the suburbs. Older people looking to live in an area that has basic services, which, in terms of the density bonuses, that's what JBG was doing. In terms of they're doing some green aspects, that's what they're doing. And I went down the list, and he said, yes, yes. He did express an interest or a concern about the workforce housing. But the only thing out of everything that's in what you have before you that he was concerned about, and he's building the building, was the three-bedroom ratio and the workforce housing. And he said, yeah, I'm doing all those things. And so then for the neighborhood folks, and again, please, Ken, jump in anytime. The neighborhood folks started to think about it and think, okay, well, they are providing me with things that we want to walk to. And so I think people generally felt that it was offering them something on both sides of the equation.
Isn't there another part of this, of my reading of the draft, that it goes back to the standard versus the optional? And so I think the question about things that are in the optional category is whether they could be of interest to some owners, some developers. So if it's in the optional category and it could be of interest to you at some locations for some reason, it's not a burden, it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. So what I got from this, and correct me if I'm wrong about that, we can go around correcting each other all night, but is that that's actually a very important distinction, that there's a fairly straightforward definition of the standard, okay? And right. Then these are the things that are within the standard, and those are the regulations on that property. Mm-hmm. And then what there is this very long list of options,
right,
that are opportunities that you can put your arms around and, you know, take advantage of, mm-hmm, or you can just walk away from and say, I don't need that 0.25 additional FAR because I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to take advantage of it.
Right, and that's what, I mean, that's exactly what, you know, a developer will do. They'll look at the cost and the benefit of each one of them. And again, I mean, I'm not arguing with any one of these in particular. I mean, these are all good things. I mean, mm-hmm, I'd love, you know, you'd love to do all this stuff if you could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, you know, can you afford it? And you know, can JBG put a couple 3 bedrooms into their, you know, into their thing? Yeah, I guess the numbers worked on that one. But I guarantee you, and did they fill up?
No, absolutely. No. They didn't. They said they would have trouble meeting the. He had a problem with the 3-bedroom requirement. Yeah. That was the one thing he mentioned.
Well, you know, I mean, and you're saying, you know, are, you know, these older couples are moving back into. I mean, can you fill a 3-bedroom? Can you rent it? Absolutely. Can you get a rent that's profitable? Very rarely. You know, it just depends. Every project's different. You know, it depends on the market and where you are. But I mean, the concern is the cumulative effect of all of, you know, all of the things that we're talking about. My biggest concern of everything I've heard tonight is the linkage fee you're talking about.
For non-residential uses.
Yeah. Maybe the linkage fee is another bonus at the end of that.
Potential. Yeah, it actually is in a bonus situation as well, but we also bumped it back so you could take advantage of the linkage and the bonus, but it was also suggested as a requirement in the standard.
You guys start looking at the demographics of what's going to develop and what's going to redevelop. What's the size of the lots? What's the probabilities? You come up with a number that's going to be reasonable to capture some of it, knowing that some it'll be so expensive they can't do it. I mean, it's a great example. A small, you know, 50-unit building, it could crush them.
Well, in fact, what we heard as the meeting ended last night, and I don't know if you heard this, about 3/4 of the development industry saying, well, actually, this isn't that bad. They do have issues with the linkage. I don't disagree with that. But both you and the chairman are right about what we're talking about. And Carl, you're right. The concern right now in White Flint is, what is that standard set at? But then someone realized that one of the proposals in the bonus table was for proximity to a transit station. If you so that speaks to, you know, the White Flint situation, where if you located close to transit, you automatically got a bonus. And you should, because the land is probably more expensive close to that transit station. You, just by being there, you get a bonus. That's the case of JBG. They would have got a bonus, and I can't remember what the number would have been, but it was significant. And they didn't really have to do very much to do that except buy land next to a transit station. So what happens is we were finding is people are starting to go down the list and start to look at those, and you're absolutely right. They're looking at, what is it costing me? But, you know, they were going to buy the land there anyway. It's a good thing that they're buying next to there. It makes it profitable for them. Just like, where's the Mark station? Royce is, we haven't decided yet, right? There's a Mark station going to go somewhere up in there. So
it's a floating Mark station.
It's a floating, yeah, right. It's a drop and roll Mark station. Wherever that happens to go, and you're within a certain distance of it, all of a sudden, those properties would get more floor area because of their proximity. So if you build down, I'm going to flip it back over. let's say you're back up in Kensington now, and you think, you know what? That proposal that Councillor Elrich is floating about bus rapid transit has real legs to it. It's a great thing. What happens if all of a sudden you're getting bus rapid transit now down Connecticut? And somebody decides to replace my hair salon, where I'm actually getting my locks cut tomorrow, and says, I'm going to rebuild on that parking lot. And as part of it, I'm going to put a really nice bus station there. That's a bonus. They get a bonus for the bus station. And it's a value to them in their building. Daycare. And this speaks right to your issue. I remember the first time I negotiated extra density with someone and said, by the way, you're giving me a 52-space daycare at your cost, $2.5 million to start up at the time. You're going to guarantee it's nonprofit for 100 years, and the city gets to approve who the operator is. We had to tie them like a cow at a rodeo and drag them down the street to sign the agreements. But after the fifth request of five different developers, we didn't have to ask anymore, because the value in the rents shot through the roof for the buildings that had the daycare. And then start to look at what that means. And I want to get back to the growth policy, because this really actually speaks to one of the issues you're raising. Think about this building now, that if somebody provides daycare, and they have all these basic services, and start to think now, whoever's parent is driving that kid to daycare may not have to drive anymore, because they're now living and working in the same place, or the drive is shorter. That's better for everybody. That speaks to the annual growth policy. Where, if you are not familiar with, the annual growth policy currently looks at school capacity and traffic. And what we're thinking is we should expand that, like California just did, to say that if you're near transit, you get more density. Aha, we just talked about that. If you build a smarter building, should you get credit for that against your mitigation for traffic? So if you haven't been watching our discussions before the board on the growth policy, I'll tell you that one of the things we're looking at is what kinds of things, very similar, in fact, many of them are in the zoning draft you have tonight, like community connectivity, proximity to basic services, and many of you have probably heard me say this before. I live a 7-minute walk from here. My wife's been in Galveston for 4 months doing hurricane recovery planning. There was a point in time where I did not drive my car for 3 weeks. In fact, I don't think I drive 3 miles a week, because I have all these things. I don't have to drive. Well, we're looking at saying in the zoning ordinance, you should get bonuses for those things. It's improving the quality of place and life. And by the way, we think perhaps you should get breaks on your mitigation fees, not the school, but the traffic. And maybe not have to provide as much mitigation because of what you're providing. So it goes back to my comment that it's not just about zoning, it's not just about master plans, it's about the annual growth policy as well. And all these things link together with all the things I've talked about. So I understand what you're saying, and I've heard it many times, and they're very legitimate concerns.
Well, I mean, I like the flexibility you're giving us here. I mean, that's great, because then you can do a cost-benefit analysis. You say,
yes.
Is it worth it for me to put the public plaza in? Am I going to get the benefit from? And that's a decision we can make. The more concerning thing is like the linkage fee, where it's just, you know,
yeah,
you got it. And
can you explain the linkage problem?
Well,
it's
just another
tax.
So if you're building, you know, a retail center, and all of a sudden, you know, you're doing
100,000 foot retail center.
Yeah, 100,000 foot retail center. Well, what's being proposed is that all of a sudden, you know, you have to make some contribution to the MPDU fund or whatever it is.
Which is currently not required.
Which is not required. And so it's just an added cost
but
to your project.
But if you only allowed 60,000 feet currently with no MPDU requirement, would you go to 100,000 with an MPDU requirement?
Well, it would all depend on the site, because, you know, with retail, for instance, you know, you can't. 2 FAR doesn't do you any good, because you can't, second floor retail doesn't really work. And so you've got a certain amount of retail that you can build. You've got to build parking. Well, if you build too much square footage, now you're going to structure parking. That fundamentally
changes.
Well,
I'm saying all things just being equal for the time being.
Right.
If all things equal, then it's worth considering. But it's usually not the case.
No, it isn't. You're right, which is what you're getting to. And I just want to be clear about it, because we're not going to answer it tonight. But
right.
It should be, I think Rollin's trying to get you motivated.
Yeah.
I'm not sure myself yet, because it doesn't sound to me like that either. But I just want to keep it as simple as possible that there are circumstances where it actually pays you, you do get a bonus.
Yeah.
And there's a public benefit as well.
Right.
Is that right?
Well, there's the other thing that I think we're thinking about, in, particularly in areas that are transit-oriented, is reduction in the parking requirement, which is an offsetting cost benefit.
But just on the net cost of real estate,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you can get lost, and I don't understand how you can find your way through it now anyway, to
yeah.
be honest with you.
Yeah.
But if it is a chart where you look at it, and it's an easy cost benefit, and it's a true benefit mm-hmm. to you, and I'm assuming that the standard zone is already costly, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, are you saying that the linkage fee is a bonus? Do you get a bonus density for it? I didn't think that's what you were saying. I thought you were saying linkage fee is just low.
Let me just go over. That the linkage fee for non-residential, which does not exist today, would kick in where you're providing more than 35,000 square feet of non-residential. So
which
if you... Office building.
It's any office building. It's any retail center. I mean, it's most.
Well, but it's a lot of the. If you're up in Wheaton and you're doing something and you're at grade, you may not be providing 35,000 square feet. So it's. In fact, in California, the cutoff's 20,000. So I upped that. So that would apply where it doesn't now. In the bonus situation, yes, you'd be getting bonus for that.
Okay.
Diane had a question really earlier.
Then you can make a decision. Yeah, it's just, you know, you can look at it and say, is it worth it?
But we're not to an incentive then. It's not an incentive.
No. I mean.
Not in the base situation.
Well, even in the bonus situation, it's not.
No.
Right, because you're not getting more for it. You're just, as a result of doing the bonus, it's a cost of that.
What happens is you're getting a bonus, and a portion of your bonus gets dedicated to affordable housing. Not the whole bonus. No.
Just to put it in context, back in 2004, in a series in the Washington Post in August, three-part series entitled Investing in Sprawl, Montgomery County and Fairfax County together were indicted by the Washington Post reporters for having a policy which is really a beggar thy neighbor policy against less affluent counties, more remotely located, because what they were doing was not matching jobs with housing. Now, that article was out there. Now, linkage ordinances have been upheld by courts. They are legal. But are they practical? The question that I think we would have to ask, and maybe we're beyond the purview of this effort here, but the question we would have to ask is, what do they do in Arlington and what do they do in Fairfax? Because I think they're working on the problem. If we put ourselves in a position where we're disadvantaged against those counties, it's a loser. But there is the possibility, if it were a just world, of having every part of the county participate in this, not just the builders of new office or new retail.
Does anyone else remember the Brookings Report, A Region Divided, like 6 or 7 sure. years ago, talking about the same thing?
Yeah.
And seeing more sprawl.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice if we could do density bonuses, because they kind of faded away in the MPDU law over the years. We just faded away, and that's a big sticking issue.
Well, can I try to moderate here for a minute and just say that I feel like the discussion's happening on two levels, and I'd like to maybe get it on one. And I would like to submit that the two levels are kind of conceptual smart growth, what's good for the community, and how this relates to encouraging that. And I would be surprised if there's anybody at the table that thinks that there's something wrong with that concept, that goal for this effort. And on the other hand, the other level is all of these techniques and all of the actual ratios, if you get this much area and here's something that we want to encourage and so on, and all the mechanisms that's supposed to make that work. And I've tried to read through this really carefully, and there's not one of the mechanisms that I know enough about to say that I'm convinced here tonight sitting at this table that that's written the right way it ought to be. So what I feel like would probably be useful to moving the conversation forward is to try to get to that second level. And let's talk about that second level. What are our questions about those mechanisms? Why are these the ratios? Why are these the things that are being incentivized, et cetera? And I feel like a lot of the conversation is sort of, I've got a problem with the mechanism, and the answer is, well, this is a great concept about smart growth. So let me kind of, again, this is like a proposition to the table. We accept the smart growth concepts here, but the issues are these mechanisms are new, they're untested to us, maybe there are other people that know them really well, but I think in a lot of ways we're really trying to focus on what's this list of new techniques and mechanisms, how are they supposed to work, why are they cast a particular way? Is that fair? Is that a fair representation of the conversation?
I guess I take a slight exception to it, because I think the word smart growth is applied to an awful lot of things, and it covers, it's just a big fig leaf that covers some things that probably should cover and other things that should be revealed. And it's used all the time. I was on the COG Citizen Advisory Board for 3 years, and we produced a smart growth video. And I'd say my one contribution to it was I made sure that the word NIMBY was not used at all in it. And so we're really leaving out a big section of the population when we talk about how we're rearranging densities and all these other things in these areas. There are a lot of people who live around the areas you're going to redevelop who care a great deal about what's going on in them. And some of the incentives that are good for developers and good for the people who move in may not be so good for the greater community. And they may be good, but that has to be part of the conversation, and those are stakeholders too. But my question to you is, did you, in putting together all of these thoughts, look at the practical reality of what's happened in this county on all of the other efforts over the last 35 years, starting with the CBD zones, as to how standard and optional have worked? I remember when I was in the planning board, we were going up to 5 FAR for CBD5 just to get anybody to build any retail, because for 10 years, residential rather, because for 10 years nobody wanted to build residential. So you had to keep upping and upping and upping the FAR, hoping somebody would bite, and I don't know that that zone was ever used, and I think you remember that.
CBDR zones?
Yeah, some, but we had to keep raising the FAR to try to sweeten the pot to get anybody to build it. So have you done any kind of reality checks on what works? And then you have cyclical economies, and I mean, you're looking at White Flint now, and people must be wanting to build residential. So you're taking your template and applying it to a willing group of people who want to build residential. But if it's a bad residential market and it's big for commercial or office, you may be finding that the FARs that they think are acceptable need to be rearranged. And similarly with the retail that everybody's going to walk to.
I'm losing track of your question.
Well, the question is, have you put your reality check on any of this?
Yeah.
Because with retail, and if I could finish, what I would suggest should be the reality check, is with retail, it's fine to walk to retail if the retail within two blocks of you is a grocery store or a dry cleaner. But if it's three banks, a brokerage house, and three real estate offices, it's not so good. And you've already built in three more stories for retail that may change, but the density stays. So
okay.
How do you guarantee those?
Yeah. Well, there's no guarantees in life to begin with. I think we all know that. Your first point about...
Sorry to use the word guarantee. Maybe if I could rephrase my question, I could get a better answer. What was your reality check on that? Because we have a lot of experience in this county with mixed use.
Okay. Going back to your very first point about talking to communities around areas where this might apply, that's exactly what happened in this room last night. Royce will tell you how involved the residential community is next to White Flint, as will Ken, in the whole White Flint discussion. And we had, a 2.5-hour discussion, or a 2-hour discussion last night, where everybody got to speak and talk exactly about the things you're talking about. Secondly, with respect to reality checks and looking in the past, absolutely. In the year starting before I got here and running up into the summer, there was a great deal of research, and we had the former director of planning in to help us with understanding what had happened in the past and what could potentially happen in the future especially with about bringing some certainty with respect to his term, the parfait of benefits, or what we say the layering of benefits. And Dick Tustian was invaluable in providing a lot of stuff, background and history about what worked, what didn't work, what direction might we be going into. And of course, we've been looking at buildings that have been built. And the most recent one would be, and Royce has heard me say this before the board about a month ago, there was a building on the block south of me at Georgia and Bonifant, which is in a CBD2 zone, I think. I think it's a two. And they didn't provide retail. They would have liked to have provided retail. We would have liked to have provided retail, but they would have lost in their units count. So it didn't work for them. That's a perfect example of where the zone worked against what we wanted. We're looking at all the strip malls in the county. What can happen? Because that is smart growth. Building smarter in Darrenstown or Olney is equally as valuable as building smarter in downtown Silver Spring, but the zoning doesn't allow you to have mixed uses on those strip malls. So yeah, we've done all those things, and we're continuing to do those things, and we're asking the all segments of the community to think about how this works for them. And
I think part of the point that's made and I think there's one thing the committee has to sort out is whether, and this gets back to Carl's point, whether these ratios and standards that are being proposed are workable over time. One of the ideas, at least that I take from this, is that by setting a maximum amount of either commercial or residential stuff is a kind of a delicate act, because in some areas we really do want the total density to occur, and the making sure that there is enough opportunity to respond to the market and still achieve kind of a minimum amount, or in some cases a maximum amount of mixed use is the act that we're trying to get at with this kind of zone.
Can I ask a different question? Sorry.
Go ahead.
I've been looking at the Gaithersburg West master plan, and one of the things you keep mentioning is traffic and AGP. And even in the Gaithersburg West plan, only so far along as it is now, apparently the traffic presumption is that you're already at 16% ridership and you're presuming you're going to be 32%. And nobody seems to think those numbers are real except you guys. And so I'm wondering, when you look at the parking and the traffic and the AGP, how tight are those tests in terms of, I mean, I know you guys are tight when you're running your numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be sure you're going to make your money back. We'd like the same, as Pat was talking about, the people who live here already, never mind the people who are coming here that we're building for, but the people who live here already would like the same courtesy in terms of traffic so that we could actually get to where we were going in the first place before the new building arrived. And so if you could just address that.
Sure. The test would be the same.
Yeah, the test would be the same. It's what how we evaluate the outcomes and what the balances are. And it's interesting to show that if you do it right, what happens to those mode shares. So, for example, and I wish Dan Hardy was here to remind me of the number, but the mode share coming out of Silver Spring is over 40%. What they found in Arlington, and I never get this number right, is the density went up over 100%, and the car traffic only went up something like 12 or 14% because so many people decided to take transit. And car ownership went down. Right.
It's a lot of metro stops in a teeny county.
Right.
Nobody disagrees with that. But
yeah.
Think.
Arlington is right now going back, and what they're thinking is that by requiring that ground floor retail in every building along the.
But they're reversing that now.
They're going back now and saying, wait a minute, look, we're not getting useful neighborhood retail, we're getting things and what have you.
Or vacant.
I was hired by the county to help on this issue, and the whole reason was people were losing money because they couldn't occupy that space. The whole blanket the ground floor concept wasn't a good idea because there was no strategy to it. It was just a gross generalization, and their strategy is about creating a merchandising mix and a merchandising strategy for a district versus just saying retail everywhere.
Well, that's my concern with this, though, is that what this is saying.
This is not saying that.
It's not saying
no. You're talking about things Arlington's dealing with now? I dealt with those 28 years ago, where we made those mistakes. And I can show you a building on a corner with 500 units in it. We got the retail on the one frontage, but not on the other. It was on the busiest street in the city. And you stand back and you think, holy mackerel, that didn't work. And so what you did is you evolve your policies. So about 20 years ago, we became very strategic to where the retail was. And if you look at the White Flint plan, and it'll be true of the Kensington plan as well, is there are strategic corners where you do have to have retail. And it would be one of the corners where JBG is actually putting it right now. But you certainly don't require it everywhere. It's not going to happen.
It makes sense when there's density. It makes sense when there's density. But if you're in Dorrinstown, okay, and there's a linkage fee attached to a 10-acre site, and the guy's going to build a grocery store anchored shopping center, a by-demand thing, and nobody's walking in Dorrinstown, okay, everyone's in the car, and you lop on a linkage fee. The hard cost in Dorrinstown is the same hard cost as it is in Rockville, Silver Spring, Bethesda. You're not getting a break because you're in Dorrinstown. The contractors actually will probably charge you more because they got to go further to bring the materials further. So if the hard costs are the same or higher, okay, and the land cost might be a little bit less, you're getting less income from Dorrinstown than you would be closer in. And then you lock this. It doesn't incentivize.
Yeah.
And that's concerning. I just don't understand.
Yeah.
But isn't that the whole point of why Dorrinstown decided to develop on septic? Because they wanted low density?
They still wanted a grocery store.
Yeah. I mean, it's not density. It's
no different.
You need a grocery
store. Clarksburg, Dorrinstown, wherever it is, just go further out. And this is a big county. We have to be rational. That's why the CBD overlays had some resounding effect, because they focused in these urban cores, which makes a lot of sense. But when you're out where it's all, I mean, I grew up off of Bauer Drive and Norbeck Road. Everybody there drives. Now, as a kid, I hoofed it everywhere, but when you went to the grocery store, and they still do it today, and there are tens of thousands of homes over there. We did a thing for ULI, I don't know how many years ago, presented it to the planning board about taking strip center. Remember that? I mean, there's a whole study that I'd be happy to share with you.
We've got
this. And we articulated ways to do that, but again, it was focused on areas where there could be density, because not every shopping center surface parking can get redeveloped. But the problem is, I'm just trying to understand how the linkage fee.
Grocery stores are exempt at a much higher limit. I forgot to tell you that.
Doesn't it tie back to how much of a bonus you get to offset those costs that the bonus requires? And what's the point, the break point between the standard and the optional, or the standard and the bonus, to see whether you get what you want in a place like White Flint? Because if the standard is too low and the optional is the only way to go, and it's too costly to get there because you don't get enough to offset that cost, then there's no incentive to redevelop what's there. And if you have a required mix, ratio of the mix, and you can't, because of the market, use part of that, so you go with the other, but you then don't get up to that total that you want, then you're not accomplishing what the plan wants in terms of creating the density there, even if you get the bonuses to get that portion for just the commercial or just the residential part.
But that's true today too.
The plan can't be responsible for the market.
No, I agree. But in setting where the standard is versus where the optional is, and what those bonuses are, how much bonus you get for X.
This goes back to pass point. You know, I mean, I think we all agree on, Carl said, you know, we all agree that it's good to have public art. It's good to have, I mean, all these, the ideas are all great. I mean, I don't think anybody disagrees with what you're, you know, the principles here. And I think what you're trying to do in terms of simplifying the code is great. And I think the fact that you're giving developers options is great. The question is, you know, for public art, is 0.1 FAR or the equal square footage of the site equal to the cost of the art? Does that make any sense? And I think that's what Pat was saying. Have you reality checked this? And I'm sure you have.
And we're exploring it from an economic study, too. But, you know, those numbers change depending on where you do it. So, you know, I can tell you I've worked in a place where it's 1% of the gross construction cost.
Right.
That's not going to work here.
Right.
So you try to find out what a happy medium is, you know, for those numbers.
Actually, let me another moderator point here is that I feel like another kind of common thread with a lot of the different points here goes to the one-size-fits-all versus the diversity of the county. And, you know, there. On the one hand, there is a lot of appeal from an administrative point of view and also kind of from a certainty point of view of having this standard that everybody knows how it applies everywhere and it's great. But I think that there also are actually a lot of, we could probably identify a half a dozen fundamentally different development scenarios in the county. That are, you know, the strip mall that's in a location where the surface parking and the density of that strip mall essentially doesn't have much opportunity to really become something different in the next generation versus places where we feel like we're being constrained because there's a character of development there today, like White Flint, where the character of development that we would like to encourage in the short term is very different. So I think it actually could help a little, maybe, to really understand how these would apply to some different scenarios as well.
Right, and that's exactly why I brought in this map for Kensington, and we're doing the same thing for Tacoma right now because those are two master plans that are going through with completely different situations. And the planners are looking at both those scenarios and are moving ahead with seeing how this overlays and plays out. Now, the key is that the number of things we're talking about, and it goes back to Bill's point, about the number of things at which you can get density for are, and I think you might have made the point, Ken, that you may choose something different in downtown Kensington versus Tacoma versus versus White Flint. The point is, it's there for you to make that choice. And you evaluate what those choices are based on your particular situation and where you're locating. But don't think for an instant that we'd be requiring retail all the way down every gray area you would. It just doesn't work. You know, one thing that's really useful is happens in a lot of condominiums I've worked on is you design the ground floor so it can adapt. So it could be residential today, and then as the market builds out, you'll see these things start to flip over. So I did a building not too long ago where they didn't want to have any retail space. I said, just design it so it can be. Well, when they put the market thing out for rent, it all got occupied by an architect who had three employees and lived in the unit, the best paper store in the city, and it just then a restaurant came in, and there's somebody living next door to it. So it allows that building to react to market changes over its lifespan.
Can you address the last point that was made at our full joint meeting by a gentleman sitting over in that seat? I don't
Bill Chan.
Bill Chan.
Okay, about the fact that with all these thresholds and all these check marks or, you know, you do this, you get this, you do this, you get this, where is the process for the Citizens Advisory Committee, which I was happy to be on for the Public Master Plan, but which does not exist for the Williamsburg West Plan, sadly. So how many other plans will it not exist for, and where is the process? Where is this
Remember.
Process?
There's going to be a lot of work sessions on the Gaithersburg West Plan. The public is going to have many, many opportunities. We can talk, that's a completely different subject, and I can talk to you about that later. But to address your question, which I've forgotten now.
It's hard to address. My question is, what if everything is sort of like a shopping list, the developer comes in and says, I'll do this, I won't do this, I'll do this, I won't do this, I want to meet that one, I don't want to meet this one, leverage does the existing community, the 50 or 70 or 90% of the people who are going to already live there and go to those schools and go to those shopping centers, where do they go?
Well, the plan is different than the zoning ordinance. I think you get your input in the plan.
That's a very good point. What we're looking for, and we want the ordinances to go forward with the plan. That's what we're trying to do in all the master plans now. But you're absolutely right. You come in, you work with the community, at large, everybody at the planning department on what should be in the plan. And the plan will continue to have statements about conformity and other things with respect to certain things. The other thing that changes in the zoning, and I mentioned it earlier, is that height limit is always there. The bonus doesn't put you above it. So now, as part of that discussion, you're defining what it is you want to see in terms of height limits and uses that you'd be getting checkmarked for. So the master map plan may say in a certain neighborhood that it's more important to have more green space. So the bonus for green space would be flushed out in the master plan, and the planners would read that, and the community would know that if that building gets built, that that's a priority for us.
Actually, Roland, let me just, a little point, just the language in here. A lot of the language in here is about the planning board may approve, ... So, you know, once you get into this whole incentive part, option part of it, it's about what the planning board may approve.
That's a big problem.
And unless the bonuses are going to take you beyond what the limits that are recommended in the plan are. So you have that upper height, then you have the amount below that the plan says it should be. And the bonuses allow you to go above one but not above the other. But unless providing those bonuses and getting that increase in height is presumed to be conforming to the master plan, you're going to always get into the argument about, well, it's above what the master plan height says, and even though it's authorized by the code, how do we make the finding, or how does the community challenge that it's not in compliance with the plan? And so you get into the same difficulty that we have today in actually accommodating the benefits of the bonuses.
Well, it gives the developer no.
I think you're taking it. Sorry, go ahead.
I have this burning question I have to ask, and this goes back to your minimum percentage of unit types. I'm sorry, it's not right where we are now, but okay. So you have 47.5% defined here. Can the rest of the units all be efficiencies if somebody wanted?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And actually, that speaks to an actual potential application in White Flint right now, actually. But back to, I think, Diane and Bill's point. We would work out, as part in the master plan discussion, you go through and see, and I hate the word parfait that came up with, but it describes it, the parfait of bonuses, and you'd start to say, okay, well, in this area, you know, some of these just don't make sense. These are a priority for us. It could be community space, for example, or something like that. That's part of the whole discussion. It's part of the master plan process.
And the master plan makes that judgment. And there it is. It says
and it's advisory.
The preference is these five bonuses. And so you come in and you do those five bonuses or whatever it is. But now instead of being 60 feet as is called for the master plan, your building is 100 feet, even though the zone allows 120.
No, we're not gonna play that game. I'm hoping we're not, you know, the board approves the master plans, but we'll be recommending a height limit in the ordinance that matches the height limit in the master plan. It's an absolute.
But right, okay. So the zone allows 120 feet.
Uh-huh.
And the master plan says, yes, but over here it should only be 60 feet. Isn't that what you've said? You've shown a height lower than the ordinance allows.
No, I drew the line lower just to represent the density between what you know as the standard and optional.
The arrow coming down. I thought that was saying that you
Oh, no. I'll draw a new one. There's a 300-foot height limit. Here's the sidewalk, okay? There's a theoretical box or whatever that you can put there. There is what we know today is a standard versus an optional floor area method. Whereas in the past, as you described, as you add bonuses to it, you go above the height limit. Here we're saying, and it was a representing, that's an absolute, but you're not there unless you start to build the bonuses up to it. I turned the arrow around for you.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So you don't have a situation where the master plan would say, even though the zone says 300 feet, the master plan says you can't go beyond 150.
I'm hoping to avoid that. If it was up to me, Bill, I wouldn't even have height limits in a master plan. But
because the traditional problem that we've had is both is the ability to accommodate the bonus density or the bonus whatever it is within the envelope.
Yeah.
And within what the master plan limits that theoretical envelope down from.
And that problem is going to get more difficult with the passage of the new legislation, Senate Bill 280.
Has to agree with master plan.
Yeah, the master plan has been elevated more to a regulatory document.
Not only to legislation, not to the individual regulatory aspects.
You're saying legislation doesn't apply to our master plan?
Legislation
seems to be.
No, the legislation says that the development has to conform to that.
Yeah, I think John's correct.
We're about to run out of time. Can I ask a really quick question about everybody in terms of scheduling our subgroup get-togethers? Daytime, evening, you know, any opinions about when we should be trying to do this again?
Evening.
Okay, and you know, this is happening regularly on a Wednesday night. Should we just pick another Wednesday evening and same time frame and everything?
You mean before the regular meeting?
Well, we're supposed to have a scheduled meeting between now and the 20th of May, just for this group.
Yeah.
So we'll do it.
Another one of those Wednesdays, yeah.
Okay, we'll just pick another Wednesday.
Maybe not the second Wednesday of the month.
Yeah,
I have a standing conflicting board meeting.
Second for me, too. Is it?
Oh, where do you go?
Okay, so
I go to the National Park Seminary Preservation.
If I can make a suggestion, we can send out an email to all of you to ask you about available times. And then arrange it for you.
Yeah. Well, actually, I feel like we're pretty good on Wednesday evening, 7 o'clock, and we'll figure out which
Wednesday.
Wednesday
7?
The only time you have some
Wednesday.
There are other
Okay.